Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am speaking to Dot Baisley all about a conversation-based approach to adoptions and how this can be utilized to remove many barriers to adoption, especially for behaviorally challenged animals. Dot is currently a core member of the Shelter Playgroup Alliance team, where she facilitates course content for their online program and in-person workshops. Most recently, she was the director of behavior for the Northeast Animal Shelter, where she built a behavior program and transformed the organization's approach to behavior. So I am so excited to talk about this topic, and I hope you guys enjoy. I am so stoked to have one of my best friends, the new executive director of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants and more, Dot Baisley, here to talk to me all about something I think I would love to see more people talking about in the way that she approaches it. So I'm going to have her start by just telling us a little bit about herself and her career path and how she found her approach to adoptions, which is what this episode's all about. And also, of course, thank you for being here, Dot.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to see you, boo.
So I know we all have these beautiful, interesting career paths, and you mm-hmm. do as well. So how did you start your career in, because I know you've worked in vet med and shelter, animal welfare, all that lovely stuff. How did you start and get to where you are today? But also, how did you find your passion to this very important topic?
I thought I was going to go to vet school. So I started working in a shelter part-time in undergrad, like typical story. But then I also had that like really desperately jacked up dog who needed a lot of behavioral help.
We all know and, this life.
Yeah. So every good trainer starts with a bad dog. I had a bad dog. I worked in a shelter. Fortunately, that shelter hired a VB. And so I started working with the veterinary behaviorist and started doing training. And that sort of changed that trajectory for me, and then realized that going to vet school was going to cause me way too much debt. So my first full-time job was a vet tech in that shelter. After I graduated from undergrad, I stayed and then got into grad school with the behavior focus, and they laid me off at the same time. So boom, like no harm, no foul there. But so the career trajectory from there was just getting a master's degree in behavioral ecology, building my own training business, staying in the vet med world, and then returning to shelters and working in shelters and building behavior programs, mostly from the ground up. So I've done that a few times in different shelters. But where I originally saw a lot of flaws within the sheltering system, particularly when I started, which was before most people who are working in shelters today are alive. So I started working in a shelter back in 1999. And my third foster dog, I took home for heartworm, because here in this part of the world in New England, we rarely had heartworm. So we didn't really know at the time how to treat it and how to support those animals through the treatment. So I took him home. We did the heartworm treatment. We did the injections. I had him for almost 4 months in my home. And I referred to him as a stealth Rottweiler, because he was the shape of a Rottweiler, but black from head to toe. And he was beautiful and he was wonderful, and his name was Sammy, and I loved him to bits and pieces. Aww. And finally got through his heartworm treatment, and the arousal issues manifested, and right. He would jump and he would grab, and he bruised me a few times, but not to the point of like it being severe or dangerous or anything like that. He went up for adoption, and I was the adoption counselor at the time, and some woman came up to me and said, "I would like to meet Sammy." And I looked at her application, which is my least favorite word in the adoption world.
Yep.
Which was 3 pages long. And before even looking at her, I did what I was trained to do, which was read every bit of information on her application, flip it over, look at it, and then look up at her and say, "I'm sorry, you have children. He cannot go home with children." Conversation done.
Right.
And she looked back at me and said, "Would you please at least meet my kids?" And I was trained. The policy at the time was no.
Right.
Right. And so I said, "All right, fine. I'm bored. Let's go out in the yard. I'll show you how this dog's going to like knock your kids over and bruise them and do all of these things."
Right.
And I walk out into the greeting space where we had this front yard where we did our adoption intros. And her 14-year-old son was bigger than me. He was a football player. He was already like 5'5", which is taller than me. And at the time, I was a 110 at the best. So he was, you know, like a linebacker. And her 12-year-old son was my size. And I'm like, how can I say no to these kids? And they did everything I asked of them. They handled him beautifully. They listened. They said, "Yes, ma'am. Thank you." Aww. And they played with him perfectly. And I was like, you know what? I might get fired for this, but I'm sending him home with you.
Yeah.
And they sent me Christmas cards for years. He slept in bed with the 12-year-old son. He went to Boy Scouts. He went to soccer camp. He had his 80-year-old, her father-in-law, come over every day in the middle of the day to walk him for lunch, right? So, like, this dog had the best life and the best family. And I realized that I was not only turning off and turning away wonderful adopters, but I was causing animals to not make it out of the shelter system that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was what really, like, the first time I realized, like, we have to have a better approach to this. Back then, this is, like, the early 2000s, there was not a concept of open adoptions or conversation-based adoptions or anything like that. But it was a sea change in my mind of, like, we have to be able to do this better. Because especially back then in New England, we were euthanizing a lot of animals.
Right.
And we were not opening our doors to the public and being open and accepting and having those conversations and being there to support people who were seeking our services.
And you weren't really working to build community since you weren't really right. having conversations, which also, again, right. it's a whole circle, of course.
Right. I remember one time, like, back then doing an adoption or like this guy came in and he wanted a cat and he clicked or checked off Mouser on his application. And I was like, "Well, you said Mouser, so no." And he left and he was mad and he like tried to fight back on that decision, which he should have, you know, because now we put cats in barns and we say, "Yay, Mouser," and all this kind of stuff. Like back then it was like, "Oh no, you don't click the right box. No, go away." And that was also when we were making, I used the, as the shelter technician, I would have to walk through the adoption floor and say, "Okay, you're a black cat. You've been here for 10 days. I have to make room." Right. How those two things like clicked in my brain and coincided at the same time as not being contradictory, I don't know. But that was the first time that I realized like this doesn't work.
And it's way more complex. I mean, I think we all know like checking off boxes and for example, like I'm a veterinary technician who's worked in animal welfare for a very long time and my life is animals. And I remember when I was going to adopt my, I have a different dog now and I love her and I'm very thankful for that. But I was looking for an elk hound. I went to I found a rescue because that's not a common breed. And literally the dog went home. This very young elk hound with different couple that was may have not been now, especially with the experience and education I have now, probably wasn't the best fit. Very nice couple, but the only reason, so literally they knew I was a technician, they knew all this stuff. and I didn't have a fence.
So literally I was just, nope.
And I will never forget that, because I'm just like, and that's still a thing now. Like that, still, that is still, yeah. And that was like 12 years ago. I mean, that was a hot minute ago, but that's still a thing.
I mean, I have a very similar story of, I had my first dog, you know, the dog that makes every good dog trainer. And then it took me a few years to convince my husband after that, that dogs were worth having. And when it came time, I wanted a Rottweiler. So I applied to Rottie Rescue. I was the manager of a vet clinic. I ran my own dog training and behavior business. And I applied to Rottie Rescue, and they said, well, we need to see your home before we let you meet the dog. And I remember being at work, they checked my vet reference before confirming receipt of my application. I happened to work for the vet. I happened to manage the practice at the time. And I was walking through reception to hear the receptionist say, no, her cats are not overweight. As a matter of fact, she has a saying, mama don't love no fatties. And I'm like, turn and I look at the receptionist, Rachel, what the? Because that's me. Like, that's what I tell my cat. I told my cat she wanted to be a fat cat. She was not allowed to be. And she's like, well, I'm going to have to stop you here because you're asking me to answer these questions about the person who literally signs my paychecks. And she was like, so yes, I think she's a good dog owner. I think you should give her any dog that is looking for a home. Now I'm going to let you go.
Right.
And then, you know, in the application, they ask you to list all of the training clubs you belong to. And I'm like, okay, here are all of my certifications.
I know. Do you want 5 pages for me? Because,
It's still like when I reached out to them, I was like, I have an offer of another dog. So I want to make an educated decision. I'd like to meet this dog first. His name was Walker Texas Ranger. So of course I wanted a dog named WTR.
Love it.
I wanted a Rottie named that, right? I had always wanted a Rottweiler since like the day I was like 5 years old, and they were like, no, we won't let you meet the dog until we see your home. And I'm like, well, if you come to my home and you see that I live in the city and I don't have a fenced in yard, and by the way, I don't put dogs that are trained for protection behind fences, are you not going to give him to me because I don't have a fenced in yard? And they're like, well, yeah, that's a strong possibility. I was like, okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go with the retired service dog that's being offered to me for free without any, you know,
right
process. Now I own Labs. I'm on my second retired service dog because they're easier to get than a Rottweiler from rescue.
And I think I understand we both have dealt with this, and it's complex, right? Especially these animals, we care a lot about them. So we're like, we have to find the perfect, people mean well, but that's not a thing. And in many cases, the narratives and boxes and obstacles that we're putting up, we're not only essentially missing out on amazing caregivers, not even giving most people even opportunities or chances for that matter. But we're also, of course, like you mentioned, unfortunately, animals are losing their lives due to this, as well as we're really not creating a relationship with the community, which is such, guys, pet retention. Yes. Building a community, like having the community feel good about your shelter, all of these beautiful things, which actually
and good about coming and looking for resources, even if that resource is surrender, right? Like they should be able to approach I always talked about it as two ends of the building because of the first shelter I worked in. Intake was at that end and adoptions were at that end. And, you know, the ones that didn't make it went out the back door. Right. But like, no matter what part of the shelter you're in at this end or that end, they should be receiving the same level of service and consideration and help that we can provide, because sometimes it does come down to taking those animals in, being the best thing for the animal, for the people, for whatever the community it is at large. And that is what we're there for. And we shouldn't be making the public feel guilty. We shouldn't make them feel less than. We shouldn't be chastising them or making decisions for them.
Right. That's a huge one. And you recently lectured about this topic, and I love everything you do. I love you. We're friends. But we became friends because there's this very small amount of behavior people, and then there's this even a smaller amount in animal welfare. So
the vet tech
behavior, I know, it's
like the vet world. Yeah.
And why I love this world, because I get to meet amazing people like you. But I've never heard this, surprisingly, or I forgot. You essentially said, when you were talking about this, customer service is our job. And you're 100% correct. Like, I talk about communication, but I've really, surprisingly, I've never heard, like, maybe it worded it that way. And I was like, she's 100% correct, but I love that she kind of simplified it with that. And again, your approach to adoptions, and again, many progressive shelters are going towards this because they've also, thankfully, as animal welfare progresses, I always say we're practicing vet med. We call it that because we're always improving. This is true of animal welfare. And you also work with behavior dogs cases and cat and dog behavior cases, which are even more challenging. So as far as your approach to adoption, I know you mentioned open adoption and a conversational approach to adoption.
Right.
I know everyone may not be familiar with what those are. So can you just go a little bit more into what those are? And then we can kind of get into how we can start to practice this and some practical applications.
Right. So, I mean, I think it originated with Pets for Life, you know, in the HSUS open adoptions, which there was a lot of pushback on because people felt that just because you're being open or the application of that meant that you would place any animal in any home. And that's not necessarily true, right? And when I started talking about how to have, so that conversation then moved to conversational adoptions. How do you meet the adopter where they are and provide them with the best service that you can for them that day? That moves to conversational adoptions, right? So the approach is that you're engaging with the person and you're advocating for their needs, which is hard for a lot of people in animal welfare to do, is to change that mindset of, if I'm advocating for the person, then I'm also advocating for the animal.
Right.
But a lot of people in animal welfare, especially people who've been doing it for a long time, come at it with I have to advocate for the animal. And that stops their ability to have that conversation moving forward. Right. So and when I started talking about, you know, open adoptions, conversational or conversation-based adoptions, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't matter to me, like, what the labels are, just like we label behavior. It doesn't matter to me what the label is. Show me the objective behavior, right? Yes. Tell me what the animal did. Operationalize that for me, please.
Describe what you are seeing. What makes you...
Right.
Yes.
I always got the pushback of, well, that's all well and good for your easy to place animals, but we can't do that with the behaviorally challenged animals because we have to protect them. We have to be very careful with how we place them. We have to do all of these things. And that, in my practice and what I've found, is absolutely not true, because you cannot control outcomes. You find beautiful, wonderful homes for some really challenging animals if you open up your mind and you advocate for the person and you approach the adoption with the concept of having constructive conversations and setting people up for success and then letting adults be adults and make choices for themselves.
And I think by advocating for the human and the animal, we're setting, like you mentioned, by advocating for the human, we're advocating for the animal. Because let's say we have a behavior challenged cat or dog, or a cat or dog with medical issues, we need to be transparent and set that caregiver or possible adopter up for success. And by kind of advocating for them and understanding their needs, you can find a true better fit, not a better fit in the narrative that you created because you already put up a bunch of roadblocks with a checkbox and or based on their appearance or based on their car, which let's be honest, that's happening. Like that is definitely happening.
And I will say that what I find in animal welfare, oddly, or used to find a lot, not as much anymore, was a very sort of classist approach to animal care.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if they can't afford the animal, they don't deserve it.
Yeah.
We're seeing those barriers really starting to break down, which is awesome. And I'm sure early on in my career, I was that way as well. But, you know, I mean, there's that ability to see what is in front of you and do what you're trained to do, but then also start to, I mean, I guess the reason why I took that job, that initial job, was the organization at the time, and again, this was the late 90s, they did not adopt out pit bulls. And in the interview, they were like, what do you think about this? And I'm like, I have a pit bull at home. She's amazing.
Right.
Wasn't the dog that, it was my brother's dog. It wasn't my dog. Wasn't the one that turned me into a trainer. He was a collie mix. But, you know, like, I was like, I don't believe that is the right choice. And they hired me. And I took that as an indication that they were ready to change that policy. And within a year or so, they did, you know. But, like, again, we're practicing better. We've come a long.
We definitely have. Yes. Which is
way since then, you know. But being able to place behaviorally challenged animals into good homes that can support them is extremely challenging. And being able to approach that in a way where you're there to support the person, you're there to support the animal, you're advocating for every person, and you're not using the word no in those situations. You're trying for yes, you're seeking yes, you're seeking what is a good fit, what is a good adoption, not the best adoption, not the best placement. Do they live at the dead end street of the, you know, blah, 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 where this dog's never going to see other dogs or other humans and that kind of stuff. But can they manage the behavior? Can they train with this individual animal? Can they meet this animal's needs? And can this animal meet their needs and not turn them into, you know, socially isolated or recluse because we've given them a dog that won't let anybody in their home.
Right.
They do need to know what they're getting into. And quite often when you sit there and you talk to somebody and you say, in your home, this is what this looks like, and this is what this is going to potentially result in. And can you, with this cat, right? When this cat bites you, not if, but when this cat bites you,
right,
are you going to be able to maintain a relationship of trust with this individual? And when you say it that way, because, you know, cats with, you know, petting induced aggression, they bite you.
Yeah.
You know, and if they say, you know what, thinking about it, I probably wouldn't be able to, then you've advocated for their needs. You haven't put the cat in an inappropriate home. And then you move on to the next one and you find them the right individual for them.
Right. And you also say, okay, thank you so much for sharing that with me, you know, and right, you can, because of course you're going to provide management and education tools. That's not just like, hey, here's this cat, he may bite you. It's not that, all of them more. And that's where that conversational approach, because I think some of the stuff, again, that we're seeing less of, but it's this whole like black and white, here's the check boxes, you match them all, go, which there's no conversation, there's no actual critical thinking, or like, humans are complex animals, essentially, yeah. Humans are complex animals and animals are complex. So as far as the components of the conversational approach to adoptions, I know that includes skilled conversation, advocacy approach to counseling, and then of course setting up each family for continued success, which I love, because something I always say when I'm talking about, because I have lots of workshops and presentations on working with feral or fearful cats and dogs, and something I always say in animal welfare, I'm like, we are so good, because I like to focus on the positive, at spay and neuter. We are so good at getting animals adopted. Now, because we're always improving, we really need to focus on, once the animal is adopted, keeping them in their homes. Like, that's really where, to be fair, I feel most to all of our energy should be going. And it is slowly. So
yep. We're getting there. We're definitely getting there. So, seeing a lot more surrender prevention and
pet retention. Like, hey, I have a food bank. We know you love your dog. You just can't afford this food this month or whatever. And that animal, like, offering veterinary care at possibly lower costs. But low cost care shouldn't mean less care, which, go back and listen to the episode I did on that, because that's something I'm also very passionate about. But as far as components of the
conversation, that doesn't exist on the behavior side yet.
Wait, right? What do you mean?
The support, the pet retention, the surrender.
Oh, yeah.
All of that is being built in the medical side and the food banks and all of that, but we don't necessarily yet have that. And for behavior, and that
is
important. And that's, I think, the next step in the future of animal welfare. Don't get me started on the future of animal welfare.
You know, for another episode. But I think there are a few people that I know of, again, not as many. Like, I recently had
It is really hard to sustain, though. Because as behavior professionals, we deserve to be paid, and we deserve to be paid well
100
for what we do. We can't give it out for free. But there's that, like, kind of not quite, you know, understanding yet that is a service that our communities need. And how do we fund that? And how do we fund it well? And how do we put qualified professionals who are not going to put a choke chain or a pinch collar on that dog or a squirt bottle or a scat mat with that cat, and give quality behavior advice in a digestible time and form that owner can take home and use and support and continue that support over time. We're not there yet, but I think that's the last step.
I think, like you said, I it's the same with vet med, right? And animal or human care. Like, when people are like, Tabitha, I would love for this. And I'm like, I love where you're coming from. And I agree with you, but we just started addressing mental health in humans. Again, it's awesome, right? Because we all know that I'm the hugest mental health advocate for humans and animals. But I think also, like, I recently had someone reach out to me to ask about a kit in kindergarten, like starting that at their shelter, that they were really interested in. And I love that. So then I got a little more information, like, how much do you have support from your shelter? Mm-hmm. How many other people are interested? And she was very honest. And she said, I'm going to be honest, like, my shelter is not in support of it. And they don't feel that behavior is very important. But then in the same sentence, she wrote, they don't feel like we can really focus on behavior right now. They want to focus on keeping animals in their home. And I was like, that is behavior. That's all. And I was like, but also, but this amazing person was trying to help, and we found some other alternatives in a practical, realistic way. But I thought I think that kind of sentence happens all the time.
Kitten kindergarten, puppy kindergarten. Yes. We're setting these animals up to be well-adjusted adults so they never hit the shelter door. You know, like, that is surrender prevention. That is the definition of surrender prevention.
Teach the animals life skills, which is what socialization is. But anyway, see me and Dot, we digress. as far as... So I know we mentioned the components of the conversational approach to adoptions is the skill conversations, advocacy adoption or approach to counseling, and then, of course, setting them up for success. So could you get a little bit more into what skill conversations consist of and how people can try to start to do that approach, or more tools if they're already doing that approach?
Right. I mean, I think the first thing is always asking open-ended questions, right? So you start with saying, tell me more about your family, not who lives in your house. Right? Because who lives in your house? I have a 12-year-old son. Tell me more about your family. I have a 12-year-old son who has special needs. He sees, occupational therapist or learning therapist 2 times a week. That tells me a lot more about what goes on in that home than a 12-year-old son.
Right.
Right. So being able to ask those kinds of questions and ask them in open-ended ways, in non-judgmental ways that elicit information. Oh, we had a dog, but okay, what happened with that individual? You know, it wasn't the right time, this or that or whatever. And making sure that you say, okay, well, what's different about now than then? Or what are, does that narrow down what you're looking for in your next companion? Because now you have that experience, you know what you could do, what you could handle, what you can't handle, what's appropriate for your living situation or what's not. And just because that individual didn't work doesn't mean the next one won't, if I can, you know, have those conversations. And make eliciting information from people, having open, honest conversations. And that is hard, right? To say, okay, here's my concern right now with placing this animal with you. Not, instead of saying, no, I'm not going to place this animal with you, I always say, A, tell me what you're looking for, what you want out of this companion, and B, if it comes up, here are my concerns with what may be challenging for you or for this animal in this situation. Now, let's figure out how we can address those concerns and set you up for success if you choose to take this animal home. And quite often that leads to the person then stepping back and saying, okay, you're probably right. This won't work for me. And let's look at somebody else.
And you're helping them come to that conclusion on their own instead of just saying no. So right. Now they're still invested in the conversation. They're not leaving your shelter saying, fuck that shelter, which again, it's not okay, but I'm just being honest. Right. This happens.
Right. It happens, right? Yeah. And when you say no to somebody, where do they go?
Right.
Right. And I think I mentioned this in my talk when I talked about this a couple weeks ago, is that quite often I will have parents come to me and say, like, you're the first shelter that took out an adult pit bull and showed it to me because I have children. Or you're the first person who asked me what it is that I'm genuinely looking for. In multiple situations where they come to me and they say that they've had a bad experience and elsewhere, they've had, even within, usually when in my last job, when things started to get dicey, the counselors came and found me. Because they're like, oh my God, I was not making a connection with that person, but because they were trying to tell me what I needed, but you asked me what I needed. And therefore, I'm more open and willing to divulge information and to give you that information so that, because I see that you're here advocating for my needs and willing to work with me and willing to work with my learning style, with my whatever else that individual may need to be able to be successful in adoption. It doesn't mean it's successful with this animal. You know, I mean, I had a situation not that long ago where a gentleman came in, had a dog. He wanted another dog, looked just like his dog. And he was like, they're going to love each other. And I'm like, I can tell you right now, the dog in my care that you're looking at is lovely. He loves humans. He does not like dogs. They make him super uncomfortable. And he was like, but I want him. And they won't let me meet him. And he was like pointing at the adoption center. Like saying, they won't let me meet him because, and I know I'm going to be a great home for him. I'm like, all right, great. We're going to meet him. And then I'm going to show you in a safe and controlled manner how this dog reacts to other dogs. And so he met the dog. He was like, he's so lovely. He's perfect. He's wonderful. I'm like, that's great. Yes, you are correct. He loves people. He's an awesome dog. Now, we're going to go outside and we're going to walk through the parking lot. And he didn't react, but he saw another dog. He increased distance. He got uncomfortable. His back roached. He moved away from the dog, and I said, look at that. See that? This is his reaction to a dog 100 feet away.
Exactly, at a distance, let alone.
At a distance. Now, can you imagine what would happen if that dog, if he had to live with that dog every day? And the guy looked at me, and he's like, yeah, you're right. Dogs make him uncomfortable. And there was no way he was going to understand that dogs make him uncomfortable without me showing him how and why I came to that conclusion.
And that's where I love the team approach too, because as an adoption counselor, they're amazing and we should be educating them about body language and communication skills, which, you know, every staff member at vet clinics and animal welfare, that's a very needed thing that isn't happening as often. And we're kind of just throwing them to the wolves essentially, which is, and then we're like, why is everyone so burnt out and angry and cynical?
Because we ask them to do the most skilled, most varied and most challenging job for no money.
And we don't help give them skills that they need. But again, that we digress, but they're not. So I love the fact that they were like, instead of being like, this guy's being a dick, they were like, I'm not communicating. We're not like,
we're not meshing
each other. We're not meshing. And then you come in, for example, like, this is where managers might come in. If there's a challenge, if I was working at like, when I used to work in like normal stores, this was a long time ago, like GNCs and stuff, like my first jobs ever, where, you know, someone would be challenging. And then, or at a lot of vet clinics I worked at, I was a lot more comfortable with some of the more challenging conversations because of my background behavior. And I had a lot more practice. So I got more skilled at it. So I love that as well. Like just being like, hey, we're not meshing well. Can you talk to someone else? Because the tension there can get high quickly because there's so much very, very quickly for both parties. And then that poor adoption counselor is feeling horrible. It's just a lose-lose. Like it really is.
And behavior is a team sport.
Yes.
Adoption is a team sport, right?
Yes.
Vetment is a team sport. We shouldn't be trying to do this stuff alone. And a lot of people, I think, feel the pressure, time, and all of the number of adopters, the number of animals to care for. There's always that pressure to get it done and get it done quickly and not necessarily spend the time. But, you know, in that case with the gentleman who wanted that dog that didn't want to go home with another dog, I introduced him to 6 different dogs. I knew the second dog was the first dog wasn't the right dog for him. We led to that and he came to that conclusion on his own. The second dog I introduced to him, I knew was the dog for him. He was a little unsure. I introduced him to 4 more dogs. The next day he came back and he adopted the second dog. Right. And I was like, great, awesome. That's beautiful. You found yours and your dog's soulmate. Go for it. That's beautiful. Right. It took time. It took a time investment, but it did result in a good placement for a great placement for the right dog.
And that's our goal. That's why we really do this. So I think the open-ended questions is great. Trying to say yes. So again, kind of working, you call it skilled conversation, saying no. Because I think so many of us, that's how we've been taught. And like you said, that's our kind of our learning history where we send these like long questionnaires or we might see something and say no in our own heads. And we're not really offering the opportunities to say yes by asking more open-ended questions and doing a lot of things you just discussed. And then also, I love that you mentioned that all adopters are different with their learning styles, their learning history, their specific needs, just like animals, because they're all the same. So I do think it's like, again, I love the approach of we really have to advocate for the person, which is then in turn advocating for the animal. But as far as counseling and presenting the animal, what are some suggestions that you have found to be successful where you've been?
I always struggle with people describing the animal a lot or talking, you know, sitting down and having this like conversation without the animal there. You put those fingers in fur, you'll let them see the positives about that individual. You talk up the positives about that individual. And you also say, but here are the challenges. And this is what these challenges realistically look like. I'm not going to sugarcoat them. I'm not going to, but here is what we've seen in shelter. Here's what we know from their history. This is what we saw during our assessment process. Complete full verbal disclosure whilst they are touching the animal. Because if they touch them, they put those fingers in that fur, they're going to fall in love and your job is done.
Right.
Not done, right? But it, right. You know, I mean, but it starts the actual, you know, setting them up to succeed. But if I sit there and I tell you this dog who you've never touched, you've never met, and you've just seen a picture of, that he's, you know, mouthed five people, he ripped the sweatshirt off of the adoption, off the kennel tech like 2 weeks ago. Are you going to take that animal out? You're going to meet that animal? Are you going to understand why that animal's needs aren't being met in a shelter setting? Yeah, no, you're not. You're going to be like, oh, okay, give me the puppy. I can raise that to be a good dog.
Right. And I think transparency is, I mean, it's something that many of us are kind of screaming from the rooftops at this point, because similar, like something I always say, obviously cats need to hide. It's a natural coping mechanism. Right. Even if you have the most low stress shelter, which, come on, let's be honest. Even in my home, I'm in a very comfortable home. I feel safe. I have psychological safety in my home. I have space, but I still need safe places and to hide occasionally. But sometimes some of the feedback that I've received from some cat shelters that I've worked with is, we don't want to place a box in there because then the cat will be hiding and won't be out for adoption. So, or won't be in front of the cage. So that's where I come in and say, okay, thank you for sharing that with me. But right. But I'm like, but I do some free consulting for a local mm-hmm. shelter. And right after the animal's adopted, I'll do like a 30-minute phone call mm-hmm. and it's a cat specific shelter. I'm not joking. Half the calls are my cat's hiding, and because this person doesn't understand, understandably,
yeah.
they're creating narratives and they're like, the cat fucking hates me. He's been in the basement the whole time. I want to return him.
Right. And
because so that's half of my calls. And then I just explain like, hey, new environment, normal behaviors. This cat doesn't hate you, like all of and it's all good. But I'm like, first off, we're causing that cat to have more fear and stress by not providing a hiding space. But also, we're creating a fake narrative that for this caregiver that cats hide. And we just set that half of the calls were that. So I only take the calls when people want to return the cat right after adoption. And literally half of them were that. If we were just transparent, guys, like,
well, that's not just necessarily transparency, but that's also setting up for success, right? Which is the next step in that process. Making sure that the person knows it. And I always, especially with cats, you know, plan for the worst, expect for the worst, hope for the best, right? I always set my expectations low and then let people get surprised by how well it went. you know, but saying like, here is what this is what we've seen in shelter. This is how we met this animal's needs. And this is what it's likely to look like when you go home with them. And this is how you provide for that individual's needs. You put the cat in a smaller space. You let them hide. You provide them. This is the setup for any cat coming into your home. Yeah. A few of them won't need it. Many of them won't need it for very long. Some of them will need it for longer. But that is how you set a cat up to succeed in a home, with the adopter knowing those expectations as they walk in. Then you're not getting those calls, because the shelter has already disclosed the behavior of the individual prior to adoption, which is, in the state of Massachusetts, we are required to disclose behavior legally by the state. Agricultural Department. I've been doing it for many years, longer than the state has required us to do so. And it is a full disclosure, written and verbal. We sit down, we go over that disclosure with the adopter, they sign it at the time of adoption, and we say, here are all the behaviors that we have seen or that we are aware of or that we know. And we also know that we don't have crystal balls and we can't see the future.
Right.
So when something changes, because you're changing the animal's environment and you're changing the context of the behavior, when something is different, here's my phone number and call me. Quite often I set up post-adoption meets with the doctors. I'm going to send you home with this animal today, and we're going to meet again next Tuesday and practice the training and the management for this individual. And if you don't need that session, all I ask is that you call me and just let me know that you're not around, you're going to come. But I'm here to support you and make sure that you're successful.
Yeah, I think that kind of continued support, which can look a lot of different ways, because I recognize that not all shelters have behavior teams, although right. that is something as we
also progress,
yeah. right, that needs to change. I mean, but we're right. progressing because, again, behavior is, I'm not biased, guys. I'm just right. Behavior is a very large, sorry, that is not, I'm not going to take that back, because behavior is such a huge component to care. I mean, it's just
yeah.
meeting the animal's basic needs, like five freedoms, all of that. That stuff. And I think, like you mentioned, we shouldn't, whether we're talking about a medical issue or a behavior issue, I think sometimes people, they mean well where they're coming from, but by not being transparent or kind of like glossing over it or not actually saying what it is,
mm-hmm.
Then that caregiver understandably was completely set up to fail. And now they have bad feelings about adopting.
Right.
They might even have a learning history of like, it's not only that shelter, I just can't adopt again. Cause, and like you said, we can't say, hey, this is for sure going to happen. Cause if anyone guarantees behavior, run. But you can
by
having that, I know, run, you can have that, start to have that conversation, and everyone knows that animals, like, there's no such thing as to be fair. My animals are perfect in my experience, but there's a lot going on. Just like you guys love your kids most of the time and think they're perfect, but you have days where they're not so perfect, and that's normal. But anyways, so I think that that's so important to, I mean, the transparency thing is just.
Yeah. The transparency, the disclosure, the setting up for success, also met with not every single time is going to work. Right. And right. so that goes back to culture and supporting each other in the shelter as staff if it doesn't work. Right. Where I am, I can send animals home, foster to adopt. It's a tool I love to use because 90% of the time they choose to keep. But there's some folks, like some states, that can't do that. The state of New Hampshire, they cannot do foster to adopt because they have to do a home visit before they use anybody as a foster home, but they don't have to do that for adoption.
Yeah. Everybody's different.
Yeah. It's strange. But being able to say, like, okay, whether or not you signed an adoption contract, because that is only important to humans, it's not important to the animal in any way, shape, or form, I'm here to take this animal back if it doesn't work, right? Because there are certain situations where you can't necessarily see the full extension of that behavior until the animal's been in a home. You may not know what that behavior is going to look like, or you may not have seen it at all in the shelter setting. But also, the person hasn't seen it. They don't understand emotionally what it's like to live with that behavior. You can show it, you can demonstrate, you can do all of the things in the shelter, and they're with you and they have the best of intentions, and then they get home and they feel that cat nip them, or the cat hides and they can't figure out how to get the cat out, or the dog jumps and mouths or barks at a stranger or lunges at another dog, and then they feel the emotions that go along with living with that behavior. And that is very different than logically understanding what it means to live with that. And if they're not emotionally ready to handle that, or it's not the right fit, or whatever reason it doesn't work, we're there to take them back. We're there to support them and say, okay, it didn't work this time. I'm here the next time if you're ready, when you're ready for the next individual that's right for you. And then making sure that we support each other in that, where we say, great try, guys. We now know more about this individual animal. We know more about what this adopter wants and needs. And we will be, you know, returns are not the end of the world. Unsuccessful adoptions, it's just like foster. They just went home for the weekend.
Yeah. And I think that the team approach and being supportive of each other is such an important thing. And let's say there was a really challenging case or a, because it happens, hey, we're going to just meet for a quick debrief to discuss that. Yeah. Like you said, say, okay, that was challenging. I recognize that. Let's talk about what we learned from this, or what challenges are you guys having? How can I help? Like, that is such a powerful tool, because it's so common that these environments are toxic and people don't have any psychological safety on top of working really, you know, emotionally challenging jobs. And if anything, guys, we should be supporting our colleagues, especially in a shelter setting. So I love that you brought that up. I think that that's so important.
And how we support each other is extremely important as shelter staff, and how we approach those situations. You know, I always used to tell my staff, because they'd say, be like, oh, well, Dot will let it happen. We'll just let her do it. Yeah, like, I'm not just letting anything happen. I'm just giving a little bit more faith in the rest of the human race. But, you know, they just saying, like, okay, mistake happened. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to get upset. Something didn't go right. We work with animals and people. Nothing is ever going to be perfect.
Right.
All I need to know is that you were trying for the best outcome. And as long as you were trying, then we're going to sit down and we're going to figure out how we can do better to try better next time.
And as far as I know, you've implemented this at a lot of shelters, and I have to make this shirt, TM, 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 but SOPs are sexy. We're trying to make them sexy. So part of that, because these are changes, and a lot of this is having skilled communication skills, which it is a skill. So one of the things that you've had a lot of success with, which I love, is kind of writing some SOPs and educating staff about these. How has that looked like? And what are some, maybe just a few tips that you could recommend to animal welfare staff who may be interested in beginning to start transitioning to this approach or strengthening the approach they already have?
I mean, it starts with training. It starts with training your staff. It starts with making sure that every staff member has at least a basic understanding of some behavior, body language particularly, and then making sure that they understand what it is that these challenges actually are and what we mean by when we say, oh, this dog is jumpy, mouthy, whatever that challenge is. They at least should be able to talk through that at some level and say, and be able to identify body language.
And how to describe, which is where body language comes in. So describing behavior and avoiding labels. For example, something I commonly hear is, this cat hates other cats. And what I ask is, I'll then ask the animal welfare person that I'm visiting and say, what behaviors have you seen that where you have came to that conclusion? And most of the time, they can't tell me much, which, so a lot of labels and narratives are being creative. So I think that's really important to help invest in your staff and educate.
Yeah. And from there, support the staff, right?
Right.
So again, behavior is a team sport. The behavior team should not be the only ones talking about this stuff. They should not be the only ones doing these things. They should not be, you know, the only ones assessing the animals, supporting the adopters, being there and working with your entire team, and making sure that they see their management and they see the leadership within the organization as approachable, and able to support them in their decisions and not ready to chastise them.
Right.
Or not like, oh, I'm not going to go to them because, you know, I got yelled at last time for asking this question, or, you know, any of those things. It comes back to being able to teach them how to be human teachers. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, in my last job, we had a whole thing about training the trainer. Right. We asked the animal care staff to train volunteers how to do basic animal care stuff. Okay. But yeah, and they can do that. They know how to do the basic animal care stuff really well. But do they know how to teach somebody else how to do that?
Right. That's a beautiful way to have them practice, I think.
Right. So this is how you practice cleaning a kennel. This is how you practice teaching somebody how to clean a kennel. There's no emotion involved in it. There shouldn't be any emotion.
Right. In most cases, I see what you're saying.
and then those people who are successful at training volunteers on how to clean a kennel then become more successful at how to train or teach a doctor's basic animal care, and then they become better at teaching more advanced skill.
And then the team is empowered because they're not only, again, you're setting them up for success, you're creating an environment that's conducive to learning, a culture that is conducive to learning, asking questions, supporting each other, which is, again, so important. So love all of that. So I figured you probably have tons. But I would love for you to share a few case study examples with a cat and a dog where you've had this approach and kind of discussing the steps so people can really kind of see the whole picture.
Well, I think one of the cat that I presented in that talk was Marshmallow.
Marshmallow.
Big white fluffy cat. So named Marshmallow, right? It was a cat who came into care. The previous owner had passed away, which is how quite often in New England, how we get our cats these days, at least locally. The rest of them come through transport. And we didn't have the ability to have that conversation with the previous owner. So we didn't have any real information other than she had lived with the same person for 10 years. And as far as the person bringing the cat to us knew, it was a good relationship, but it was, they didn't have any detail beyond that. And she came into care and she was fractious for a label. she would hiss and swat anytime a person approached her. The medical team attempted multiple times, and this was a cat vet. I mean, my previous medical director was a cat. She is a cat.
Aww.
She's not a cat person. She is a cat.
Yes.
She tried, and the cat wouldn't, and we tried gabapentin and trazodone, tried to get all of these things into her. This cat would not eat if we were there. She waited until the evenings to eat when we were, you know, shelter was closed down. And anytime I attempted to sit with her and talk to her, or do the like slow integration and start working with her, she would hiss and swat at me. And I tried food, I tried, you know, distance, I tried sitting and reading on my cell phone, all of the purr apps, I was trying a lot of things. Pretty much every day I would come and visit her twice a day and see what I could find that she liked or enjoyed. And I came up with nothing for a very long time. And eventually I had a telescoping back scratcher. And I tried the claw end of the telescoping back scratcher with her, and she batted it away and hissed at me and was like, I'm gonna stay in my hidey hole where I spend all of my days. Go away, lady. And I turned it around and just put it down in front of her, and she like almost thought about bunting it. And I was like, okay. So I went and I got a Furminator, like that hard metal, and I put that down where it had been so she didn't have to reach to bunt. And she started rubbing on it and bunting it and rubbing her mouth on it, like her chin and her mouth. And she really actually engaged with the Furminator. And I was like, okay, finally found something this individual likes. So I picked the Furminator up and held it and then started took a brush, because you like to be groomed, apparently. And that's what we're going to do. And I started brushing her. And when she would take her face off of the Furminator, I would stop brushing. She'd go back to the Furminator, I'd start brushing. And so that was the first time in 3.5 weeks in care that I had any direct non-reactive interaction with this cat. And I was like, okay, we're going to keep doing this. And then I went and looked on the internet and I found this really weird back scratcher that had these nubs on it and bought that from Amazon. And
it's kind of similar to a Zoom groom, if anyone is familiar
with
that.
But it's hard.
And it's on an extension, so Dot can be far away because she's a trigger and it's not personal.
Right. So extendable back scratcher with the hard plastic nubs.
Love it.
Shorter nubs on one side, longer nubs on the other. And I started using that. So she would bunt on that and I would brush her. And as soon as she stopped bunting, I stopped. So it was an on-off switch, like telling her, you get to control this interaction. You tell me when to go. You tell me when to stop. I adhere to those conditions. And by the end of the third session, I was able to actually pet her and she started bunting into my hand. Couple of days later, I had a couple who came in that wanted a cat. They didn't care how affectionate that cat was with them. They found her to be beautiful. So we sat down, we went through all of at that point, it was about 4 weeks of information plus the surrendering information. They're like, that's okay. We think we can be successful. I was like, great. I gave them the disclosure. I showed them how I had worked with her. I demonstrated it to them, had them demonstrate to me their ability to do it with her. And then spent 15 minutes getting her into a carrier without touching her. Didn't right. touch her. I just, you know, made the carrier nice and happy and somewhere to hide, and then took away all of the other hiding places and walked away and came back 5 minutes later and closed the carrier and sent her home.
Yes.
And followed up a week later on the phone with them, and they said she loves her back scratcher that I sent home with them. I bought with my own money.
I was like, we've all been there, y'all.
Yeah, no, the shelter would have reimbursed me, but I was too lazy to seek a $13 reimbursement. sent them home with the back scratcher. They said that she's the most affectionate cat they've ever owned in their lives.
Aww.
Because they followed the protocol of not touching her until she asked for it and she engaged in that. And they used the back scratcher, they used the on-off button cue. Took them 3 days. They needed some help with the litter box. She wasn't quite making the litter box. And so then we moved to a wide, low edge litter box where she wasn't peeing out the sides. And that was the only
appropriate size litter box, everybody. Dot helped with education. Beautiful.
Right. and that was their only issue when they got home was that she wasn't quite making the litter box. And so I was able to help them answer that question. It was a 20-minute phone call. A week later, post-adoption, they knew that they could call back anytime they ran into any issues. And as far as I'm aware, to this day, she is extremely happy in that home, and they still are as well.
I love it so much. And then I'll have you share a dog example, because I know I could just talk to you forever, but a dog case study.
Oh, which
one? I know, which one? You're like, there's so many. And you guys all out there have all your favorite cases, too.
Yeah. We had a dog. We actually had four dogs that came up together. They were a litter of four, 7 months old, all extremely fearful. The most fearful one, his name was Timber. And we would sit, we would toss treats, we would do the treat and like walk and drop treats. And this dog, like, I was concerned that this dog like had zero socialization with humans. And we tried for a while. I would say about a week in kennel to start eliciting, developing a relationship with a couple of people. We've narrowed down who his caregivers were, where he was housed, all of these things. Tried introducing him to the rest of his litter. At that point, they didn't enjoy each other's company. So we ended up transferring two of them to another location. And then one of them was less fearful and was able to get adopted fairly quickly. But Timber wasn't. And so we put him into a crate in his kennel, and he really never came out of the crate. It was very difficult for us to clean the crate. And so then we put him into an office to see if we could start to habituate. I would probably say there was some potential flooding going on there, but it was a small office. We didn't have a lot of choices.
Right.
And then I brought my dog in to work one day. And I'm not a fan of, like, you know, using your own dogs or doing that kind of stuff. But I know my individual and I don't use him a lot. And I just let him, like, walk up to the window of the office. And Timber came out of his crate. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, I know. You're like, data.
So I opened that door and I let my dog do what he knows how to do, which is run away from aggression. which he didn't. He came in and he sat down next to me and he's like, hey mom, what are we doing here? Why is there this weird dog here? And this weird dog's like checking him out and actually like being animated in my presence. So I was like, okay, great information. So I built that relationship with my dog and then started building his relationships with other dogs in the shelter and using that social bridge of like, people come with dogs. People come with dogs. People right. don't touch you. They touch the other dog. And then we've had him in that office for a while, but we're able to start using food as a reinforcer, using some treat and retreat and other techniques like that with him. And then we had adopters who were interested in adopting him, and they had a dog at home. And they were like, we think we can do this, but we're not quite sure. So they came in multiple times. The first time they came in, I let them meet the Timber with my dog just to show like the progression of the behavior.
Right.
And then they started coming in and spending time with him with their dog. And then when they were ready, and it was totally, I let them make the decision of when they wanted to pull the trigger and take that dog home. They finally, I think about after 5 visits, we're like, okay, we're ready to take him home. We put him in his crate. We dropped him off at their house. We set him up with baby gates and, you know, controlled introduction to the other dog, all of those things. And I got a call from them about a week and a half later, and they were like, we don't think we can keep him. I'm like, okay, what's going wrong? But like, what's the issue? And they're like, well, you know, it's just a little bit harder than we anticipated. I'm like, that's great. And they're like, but we don't want him going back to the shelter. I'm like, even better. So they're like, we will continue to foster him until you find the right home for him. I'm like, thank you.
Yeah.
So then he went back up for adoption on our website, and he happened to be a cute little, you know, like cattle-y dog mix thing. So we got a lot of interest in him. And I found a family that had 4 other dogs that basically lived like an off-leash lifestyle, which Timber kind of needed because at that point he hadn't even been leash trained because we couldn't get close enough to him to actually like put the leash on. And they had like an open floor plan with their 4 dogs, all of which were with, you know, different shades of social to humans. and they came to the house. I went to the foster family's house with them and met Timber. And they sat down and there was mom, dad, and older teenage daughter. Very thoughtful people. Extremely thoughtful people. And they were like, yeah, we can totally do this. And so they came back the next, like 2 days later, they came to the shelter first, signed the adoption paperwork because they wanted to sign the paperwork. They didn't want to foster. They just wanted to adopt him. And then they drove over to the foster family's house and the foster family helped them get him in the car and took him home. And the only follow-up I did was 2 emails and a phone call. And those emails were photos of Timber running around their yard, like saddling up next to one of their dogs, sleeping on a dog bed with another dog. And they said, we're not quite ready to leash train him yet, but he is fitting perfectly into our lives. And when we go to our other home, because they had that luxury as well. In a month, we go to our summer home. We're going to probably have to leash train him, but he's reliable enough in the crate that we can get him in and out of the car and to do the transport and all that kind of stuff. So
I love it. And that's a more severe behavior challenge case. And another win that out of this approach, obviously, is you can also build a pretty amazing team of volunteers and fosters who are already, because you know, on a past episode, we talked about investing in your volunteers and how beneficial that could be. But they're already more skilled in some contexts because of what you taught them. And they offered to foster the dog without you even saying that. And then they may be interested in fostering in the future, and they already have some tools that are more advanced. So it's just beautiful. Oh, chef's
kiss. They did end up adopting a different dog from a different organization, but they ended up being donors. So.
Oh, the donor. You guys, money's important. I forgot about that. The donor thing too. I mean, it's very important, like building good relationships and rapport. And well, thank you so much for sharing all your amazing knowledge, you beautiful fucking person, you. The way I end the podcast is I always like to ask my guests what is something that currently makes them happy. This could be the fact that we got to see each other like 3 times in the last few months. Oh my God, it makes me happy. In real life, she lives in Boston and I live in Ohio. So,
and I get to see you again.
I know. I'm going to Boston for Bane, which is this hardcore band that I'm obsessed with. So I get to see her again. But what is something that makes you happy right now?
Okay, so total dork.
I love dorking. We embrace dorks here at Tales from a Vet Tech. Yes.
What makes me happy right now is my 2 new jobs. You know, I'm the executive director for the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, and moving the behavior profession forward makes me happy.
Yes.
Improving and supporting animal behavior professionals. Absolutely. But then also being a behavior consultant and in a side of an animal clinic, and it's a really great clinic, and the people who work there and the owner and her entire team are like amazing humans. And so I've been doing that for a few months now, and it was an odd switch for me going back into private practice after
so long. Yeah.
Yeah. 15 years of not really working with owned animals, and now actually seeing clients over time and working with their animals and seeing their relationships improve, and seeing the changes in behavior that they're able to accomplish with their dogs and their cats is pretty amazing.
Oh, I love it. Yes. That's a separate episode that I'm totally going to do, because I have the pleasure of working with a lot of veterinarians. And I think, obviously, I'm also a vet tech and all that lovely stuff, but there is so much strength and positive things that can happen when behavior professionals and veterinarians have a team and work together, whether it's as a consultant or like a part-timer. It just makes all of our jobs easier. But that will be another topic for another day. So thank you so much, Dot, for chatting.
Thank you.
What an awesome conversation. Shout out to all my amazing animal welfare professionals out there. I would love to hear how you are removing barriers to adoption. There's so much amazing stuff happening in animal welfare right now, especially towards this topic. And I would love to hear what's working for you. You can contact me at talesfromanrvt@gmail.com, or you can find Tales from a Vet Tech on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Have a wonderful day, everybody.